All right, we're ready for Deuteronomy chapter 25 and 26. This will wind up the second sermon of Moses as he presents three or four sermons. We'll talk about the distinction in three and four as we have previously. We'll do that when we get toward the end of what seems to be the third sermon. But be that as it may, we are finishing up tonight with chapter 26. That ends this second sermon that began in chapter 5. And this is the subsections of that as we finish up with reference to the judgments. I mention that because, if time permits at the end, we're going to explore a summary. And so be thinking, how would you summarize? It's much like you hear a sermon that I may preach or some other preacher may preach, and if someone asks you when it was over, what was that about? Give me the summary of that. What are the two or three points that were made, or four, whatever it may be? How would you, you've heard this sermon, how would you summarize this sermon from chapter 5 to 26? And be thinking about that, and you can give your summary, if time permits, in just a little bit. So we are finishing up that second speech in our study tonight. Let's review some of these chapters where we have been. Chapters 1 through 4 is the first sermon. Chapter 1 was... a review from Sinai to Kadesh. This is history. Chapter 2. All right. And then chapter 3 was victory over Og. All right. Chapter 4 ended that first sermon with necessity of obedience. Sound familiar? Well, it should. All right. Chapter 5 begins this second sermon. And so here we have the Ten Commandments and the fear of God. Chapter 6 backed up and gave a broader view. Kind of an overview of the law there. All right, chapter 7, all right. Chapter 8 comes back to the theme of chapter 4, obedience and keeping the commandments. Chapter 9, about pride and self-righteousness. You're not doing this on your own. Chapter 10 deals with mercy and obedience. Chapter 11, love and obey the Lord. Chapter 12 talks about, and repeatedly through the Old Testament, we're going to be seeing, particularly in Deuteronomy, the place where God chooses. That's referring to this event of chapter 12. All right, chapter 13 dealt with the destruction of those who lead to idolatry. We're going to skip 14 and 15, not because they're not important. 16, annual feast. 17. And 18 dealt with... and a prophet like Moses. Very good. All right, chapter 19. Very good. Chapter 20. And then 21 and 22 we dealt with, we label as being miscellaneous laws. We're going to have the same thing in our study tonight. And then chapter 23, last time, dealt with purity of the congregation and the camp. And then 24, divorce, as we... think about Deuteronomy 24, 1 to 4. All right, question number one for tonight is answered on the screen before you, so we'll not take the time to go through question one at this moment. We'll come back to some of the others. But chapter 25 deals with miscellaneous laws, as do many of these chapters in chapters toward the end of this section from about chapter 19 on. But I put in parentheses here as a subtitle to that, fairness. Nearly everyone, if not every one of these sections, these are not necessarily sequential, meaning because this is true, this follows, nor are these necessarily one based upon the other, that this one is tied with that one. Perhaps number four might be tied with number three. We'll talk about the significance of that a little bit. But say five and six are not tied together. These are, again, just miscellaneous laws been grouped together and thrown together. But they all seem to relate to fairness, some sense of fairness. And God set out for there to be fairness in his laws. So let's get underway and talk about these. Here is punishment of the wicked when they are and when they are to be beaten and the restrictions thereof. There were certain laws that had been already given, we've talked about, and I'm not going to go back through those, but there were certain laws that required the execution by stoning. But there were other sins, crimes, or that are to be punished that were not necessarily the weight so that it carried capital punishment. Sometimes it would be you're put out of the camp for a little bit. But much of that would be left to the judges. There are judges that are mentioned here in the context, like at verse 1, verse 2, and in verse 3, these judges are mentioned. And they would be those that would make the decision of what was to be done, and in this case, how many stripes that they would receive. So, if there's a dispute between people and they come to the court, and the judges just judge them, and they justify the righteous and condemn the wicked. Some translators have suggested that the righteous would be the innocent and the wicked would be the guilty, and probably would be better translated thus, that not so much that here's a righteous person who doesn't need to be punished and here's a wicked person. Not all wicked people were to be beaten. Not all wicked people were to be put out of the camp. Not all wicked people were to be stoned. So it's probably talking about those that are found guilty in this dispute. So here's one that's guilty and one that's not. And if the wicked man or the guilty man deserves to be beaten, then the judge, according to verse 2, would give a certain number of blows. Well, you say, well, the number is given. No, the number is not given. The limitation is given in the next verse. We'll get to that in a moment. But I think what the point being made is that the blows or the stripes are to be commensurate with the crime. And if the judges have judgment and have wisdom, they will execute that accordingly. So here is one that has committed this crime, but this one's much worse. They're going to get more blows. So now what's verse 3 tell us? Yeah, the limitation was 40 stripes. Now we'll come back to that 40 stripes in just a second, but let's go on to the end of the verse. 40 stripes you may give him, and he's not to go above that. And your brother be humiliated, lest your brother be humiliated in your sight. In other words, you degrade him. He is to be punished. He has committed a crime. He's committed a sin. He is to be punished, but he's not to be executed. And so he's to be beaten, but you're not to be extreme with reference to that. The Code of Hammurabi, I think, gave a limitation of 60 stripes. The Assyrians had 50 stripes, I believe it was. And God here puts 40 stripes. Now, 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 24, Paul talks about he was beaten three times with 40 stripes, save one. That'd be 39. And so the Jews, in order to make sure, lest they go beyond the law, and they exceed this requirement, stopped at 39. And that's why they gave him 39 stripes. So generally, the Jews gave 39 not to go over the 40. So in other words, 40 was the limitation. Not that that was the number he's getting. He might get 5. He might get 3. He might get 2, depending on what he's committed. Make sense? All right. So 2 Corinthians 11, 24 tells us by the New Testament times, the Jews were still following that principle of that law. All right, let's go to number 4, verse 4. Seemingly unrelated, again to do with fairness, you shall not muzzle the ox while it treads out the grain. What's that talking about? All right, very good. Chapter, let's go to question number 2. Second part of that, where is this quoted in the New Testament? 1 Corinthians 9 and in verse 9 and 1 Timothy 5. Let's talk about the context of those two passages and then we're going to go to 1 Corinthians 9. In 1 Corinthians 9, Paul is arguing for, let me start over. In 1 Corinthians 9, Paul is arguing for, this is where you take off and finish the sentence. The support of gospel preachers, yes, support of preachers. Now, that's not really the thrust of the chapter. The chapter is dealing with 8, 9, and 10 deal with liberties that are not exercised. That's really the point. And one of the liberties was taking support. And Paul had every right to take support, but he denied that. In other words, he declined that, I guess is a better term. But what evidence is there that he could be supported out of the church treasury? Well, he said, you shall not muzzle the ox while it treads out the grain. He's quoting from Deuteronomy 25. All right, keep your finger there because I'm going to come back to that. In 1 Timothy 5, if you want to turn there, he's talking about not support of preachers, but uses the same argument, same passage to deal with the support of elders. That is, supporting elders for their work. Is it scriptural and is it right to pay elders to do their work? Is there such a thing as full-time elders, as we have full-time preachers? And the answer is yes. Have you ever known of that? I have. Perhaps you've not known of one, but I've known of cases where men were paid full-time to serve as elders. And 1 Timothy 5 talks about that. Well, let's go back to 1 Corinthians 9. When Paul quotes that, notice at the end of verse 9, is it oxen God is concerned about? Isn't that interesting? Have you noticed that statement? We gloss over that when we're going through 1 Corinthians 9. Is it oxen that God's concerned about? And the answer is yes and no. Is God concerned about the oxen? Well, certainly so, because that's what he talked about in Deuteronomy 25. But really the point being made is the labor is worthy of his hire. That's the thrust and that's the point. So as the ox is treading out the grain and the grain is on the threshing floor and the ox wants to eat of it, you let him eat of it because he's working. Do not muzzle the ox while it treads out the grain. But the point of that, and that's the point Paul is making in 1 Corinthians 9, he's not just talking about oxen. The point is that man and animal both, the laborer is worthy of his hire. You're using the animal for labor, feed him. The same thing is true with the man. He's worthy of his hire. Make sense? Fairness is what comes to play. Any questions or comments on Paul's use of that in those two passages? All right, let's go to verse 5 through 10, the responsibility to a brother's widow. Why is this familiar ground to most of us? Now, the first part of that, maybe the blows may not be as familiar. Why would this be familiar to us? Because? Yes. All right, Matthew chapter 22, when the Pharisees came to Jesus, Sadducees, who denied the resurrection, came to Jesus. They argued from this text, if there is a resurrection end of time, and a man dies, and then his brother marries that widow, and then he dies, and then next brother, until all seven brothers, then whose will he be in the resurrection? And they were basing that on this text. So let's work through this text and see what we've got here in this context. This seems to be, well, I say seems to be, it specifically stated verse 1, where the brothers are dwelling together, close by at least, and are inheriting from their father. But if a brothers dwell together and one of them dies and he doesn't have a son and he's married, the woman shall not marry a stranger. Now, there's a reason for that that we're going to talk about in just a second. She shall not marry outside the family, but the husband's brother shall marry her and raise up seed to him. Now, notice at verse 6, the firstborn son is going to succeed to the name of the dead brother. In other words, going to carry his name on, and it be treated as his seed. So let's stop just for a moment and talk about what that accomplishes. That accomplishes, number one, that it secures the family inheritance, so that it's passed down to the firstborn, etc. So it secures the family inheritance. But that's not the main thing, I think. But it preserves the family from extinction. So here is the firstborn, perhaps, and he dies before he has a son, that his brother can raise up his firstborn for him so that the family inheritance and the family name goes on, lest the family become extinct. Does that make sense? All right. So that's being accomplished. And so what if the man doesn't want to marry her? Verse 7. She goes to the elders and calls him, and if he stands firm and says, I do not want to take her, now then, verse 9 is quite odd. What happens at verse 9? Take his sandal off of his foot and spit in his face and answer and say, so shall it be done to the man who will not build up his brother's house. And so what's that all about? Pulpit suggests Do I want to start there? There's another reference or two I might add. I believe it's Kylan Dalich that talk about the Psalms. I don't have one is in Psalm 60 something, but anyway, where setting foot upon property, using the foot in the sandal, had to do with the pronouncement of ownership. And so there was a connection, a great connection with the use of the foot and the sandal, etc. I'm not so much interested in that, but pulpit suggests this was a symbol of rejection of the owner of the sandal or the shoe. So by forcing the shoe off and tossing that shoe from him or removing his shoe is a statement of rejection of him. I am rejecting you and you are a rejected person. And then she says what? Or what shall would Israel say? His name shall be called in Israel. Yeah, that's the man that had his sandal removed. Well, that doesn't mean anything to us. If I introduced you to a man and I said, well, he had his shoe taken off, you'd say, well, why don't you go get him another shoe? But that was a statement of rejection. Does that make sense? This man refused his responsibility. This man refused his obligation. And now he's known in Israel as the man who refused his obligation. And so he was humiliated in front of the elders by the woman that he rejected. Does that make sense? Now, like what Bible Knowledge Commentary said, this illustrates how God used social pressure to motivate his people to obedience. That's powerful. Do you think of any other cases where that's done? I said, can you think of any other cases where that's done? I'm checking the mic. It's working. Withdrawal, yeah. Doesn't God still use that? This was a powerful tool. That here, when he realizes, I've got this obligation, and she's wanting me to marry her, my brother died, and God said I should, but he refuses to do that. And so he might think twice about that. I don't want my sandal to be removed and be known as the man whose sandal was removed. And I don't want that to be told everywhere. I don't want that humiliation. And so he then fulfills his obligation. So that's not the last time God used social pressure to encourage obedience. All right. Now Matthew 22, if you want to flag a New Testament reference about that, Matthew 22 is based upon this passage. That is, the Pharisees' misinterpretation of things is based upon their understanding of this text. They got part of it right. He's to marry, and this one's to marry, and then that one's to marry. But the implication of that, they got it all wrong. Questions or comments on that? Now, verses 11 and 12 may be closely related to that. I say maybe. You can judge for yourself. This gets a little delicate here. But we'll try to deal with this as we have some other delicate issues in the context. If two men are fighting, it just poses a circumstance where two men are fighting and the wife comes to try to rescue her husband. She's going to try to defend him. And she puts her hand and seizes him by his private area, and then her hand would be cut off and your eye shall not pity her. Sounds kind of extreme. Now, what connection does that have? Number one, it may have a connection here with the previous section, only in the sense that you're trying to protect family generations continuing. And perhaps by her doing so, that she's endangering his ability to have children. And that may be the case, why that's the case. And that's speculation and conjecture, that certainly. But several have raised the question, why is that mentioned in close proximity and on the heels of this previous thing? Is there a connection at all? There may not be any. If there is any, that may be the connection for what that may be worth to you. And by the way, this is the only punishment that involved mutilation that I know of. There may be other cases, but I'm not well aware of that. The eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth had to do with being commensurate with the crime. Not so much that you were to literally put out the eye, but an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth had to do with being commensurate with the crime. As we've already talked about. This is the only one that I know of where there was some mutilation of the body because of a sin that has been committed. So if she did that, it seems that she's doing more than just not playing fair. She is endangering something and perhaps his ability to have children. I don't know what else to do with that. It is what it is, so read that and interpret it as you wish. But those principles of that being the only thing involving mutilation, I think, is true. All right, now let's talk about integrity in business. We're going to flag some proverbs here along this line. What's the point of verses 13 to 16? All right, honest measures. Don't use differing weights, a heavy and a light. For example, if you're set up for business, you might have a heavy weight, put it on a scale, and have this one labeled as 1 pound and a lighter weight labeled as 1 pound. That's dishonest. You're lying. And if you're buying something, you're going to use a heavy weight. If you're selling, you're going to use the light weight. And so that you're getting more and you're gaining more when you sell. So that's dishonesty. I've heard stories of guys who are selling meat and selling it by the pound, and then he's putting his thumb on the scale while he's putting the meat on there, and then he's telling you he sold you 2 pounds of meat, and he actually maybe a pound and a half. Absolutely. Done over and over again. So, integrity in business, and God says here at verse 16 that to be dishonest is an abomination to the Lord. So make sure your weight is perfect and just, and so that your days may be lengthened. So what's the correlation of being honest and fair and your days being lengthened? Is that a promise to you as an individual? You're honest, you're going to live longer? The answer is no. So what does that mean? We've talked about that several times. The nation of Israel, if they obey God, their days in the land are going to be prolonged. Make sense? Did they obey God? No. Were their days prolonged? No. So it came true. Let us flag some passages along that line. We're not going to take the time to turn and read them. Proverbs 11:1, Proverbs 16:11. I'll give these again. Proverbs 20 and in verse 10 and also verse 23. What are those passages? Those passages talk about the same principle in Proverbs of just measures and weight. That's Proverbs 11:1, Proverbs 16:11, Proverbs 20 and 10, and Proverbs 20 and verse 23. All right. Now let's talk about the destruction of the Amalekites. 17 to 19 to finish this chapter and make it our way through 26. Interesting term here that we may talk about later, as in a sermon, and we flagged this several times. Remember. God, all through Deuteronomy, will say, remember. Remember. And notice at the end of verse 19, you shall not forget. Remember, and you shall not forget. There's some things God never wants us to forget. We'll say more about that perhaps at another time. Now, what does he want them to remember? All right. How Amalek, the Amalekites, had attacked along the way. Let's go to Exodus 17. You might flag that in the margin of your text. Exodus 17, verses 8 through 16. And the Amalekites were descendants of Esau. They were a nomadic tribe, meaning they roamed around. They didn't have a certain region they set in and stayed in. I'm not going to take the time to read 8 through 16, but this is the case where they have attacked. And so they go to war with the Amalekites. Now, Deuteronomy gives me a little more insight. In fact, you may have a note in Exodus 17 in the margin of your text that Deuteronomy 25, 17 to 19, that's our text, states that the defeat was well deserved. That's not so implied and stated as explicitly in Exodus 17 as it is in Deuteronomy. Does that make sense? So let's go and see what it says. Here's why it's deserved. verse 18, what'd they do? When Israel was traveling, they attacked from the rear. And that is the stragglers and those that were tired and weary. That is, they fought unfair. And so here they come, and they attack from the rear. And why did they do that? There's a reason. And you might have the answer in answer to question number 9. All right, they're tired and weary. But why did he attack those that are tired and weary? Bingo. They did not fear God. They had no respect for what's right. They had no respect for justice. They had no respect for fairness. So I'm learning something by implication. So let's go to question number 9. Did we learn anything about the fear of God? Yeah, we just did. There's some people who don't fear God. But in the context of laws that have to do with fairness, why does he mention this? Well, it may be because here was a case where people were not fair. They didn't play fair. They didn't show concern and care for others, like Amalek. Make sense? All right. So let's see what happens at verse 19. That it shall be that the Lord, when God gives you rest from all your enemies, that is, you've gone in and you conquered the land, then I want you to blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven, and you shall not forget. So this was not part of the conquest. So they're going to go in a central campaign and a northern and a southern campaign, and then they've conquered the land, and now they're settled in the land. But there's more fighting going to take place. We've noticed that already. And so then I want to make sure that you wipe out the Amalekites. That's after you've conquered the land. Does that make sense to you? So this is an additional war coming later on. So when did this happen? Well, get ready to flag a couple of passages. This doesn't happen when they first get in the land. This happens under the leadership of Saul and ultimately David. 1 Samuel chapter 15, starting at verse 1, and 2 Samuel chapter 1, beginning at verse 1. So Saul fought against them, and ultimately David defeated them. Does that make good sense to you? So when did this come to play? Not when they march into the land, and as soon as the conquest is over, sometime thereafter. They did remember, and they did not forget. All right. Let's go to chapter 26. Here's some ceremonial obligations here. In chapter 26, and the first two of these go together. In fact, all three sections go together, I think. And I'm going to defer to Kaufman's combining these together in a way that I think are helpful, and I'll get to those in a moment. But first of all, there's this offering of the first fruits, verses 1 through 11. Then there's the offering of the third year of the tithe. Now, we've seen that before. We'll flag where we've seen that in just a moment. But I go ahead and mention those two together because I think perhaps Bible Knowledge Commentary's got a point here. That they suggest that these two rituals were probably done, that are mentioned in this context, one time and one time only once they entered the land. Now, did they still have the third year tithe and offering of first fruits at other times? Yes. That was to continue perpetually. But this seems to be some instructions for when they first enter the land. And you think not, then have it. I'm not going to argue that. But I think that's a valid point. Now, I'll flag some references maybe that give us some insight to that like verse 15 and some other verses as we go through that. So anyway, here's what Kaufman suggests. That verses 1 through 11 is an acknowledgement on the part of the worshiper that God has fulfilled his promise. Let's work through that and then we'll talk about his summary of the second section. So what happens in verses 1 through 11? Well, notice that when you come into the land, there's one of those references. Once you come into the land, once you get there, that I'm going to give you, then take some of your of the first of all the produce that and you put it in a basket, then what do? Verse 3. You take it to the priest and you say to him, I declare today that the Lord your God, that I have come to the country which the Lord swore to our fathers to give us. Here is an acknowledgement, as Kaufman said, I think he's right, that offering of these first fruits, this is an acknowledgement to God, you kept your promise, you brought us in the land, here is the first fruits from the land that you gave us. You gave us this land. Then the priest will take the basket and do what? Yeah, set it down by the altar, before the altar of the Lord. And then you'll answer and say, so here's a ceremony. That's why we call this ceremonial obligations. Kind of ceremony you're going through. So you bring your first fruits once you get in the land. You come and you bring it to the priest. It's in a basket. He sets it down. And you say, I brought this because the Lord blessed us and brought us into the land. And this is the first fruits of the land. And so he sets it down. And then here's what you say. That my father was a Syrian. Speaking of Jacob, Israel. He fled to Syria, fleeing from Esau. So it's talking about Jacob. He was about to perish, and he went down to Egypt and sojourned there, few in number, and became a nation. So they went to Egypt. It's their history. And then they became populous. But the Egyptians mistreated us, and they were hard on us. And so the Lord God heard our voice, and he brought us out of Egypt, verse 8, with a mighty hand. Here's our history, in other words, with an outstretched arm, with great terror and wonders and signs. And he brought us to this place and gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. God, finish my sentence, kept his promise. All right. Y'all didn't drink your coffee before you came, did you? Verse 10, and now, behold, I brought the first fruits of the land to you. We came into the land. God gave it to us. Here's the first fruits that God's blessed us with. And so you should set it before the Lord and worship the Lord so everyone will rejoice. Now, I think Kaufman's got a point. This was an acknowledgement on the part of the worshiper that God kept his promise. He brought us to the land, brought us from out of Egypt, etc. All right. Now let's go to 12. Any questions or comments on that? All right. Let's talk about 12 to 15. This is the offering of the third year tithe. Now, where have we seen this before? Well, let's back up to chapter 14, same book, Deuteronomy, chapter 14, 28 and 29. One of the reasons that Bible Knowledge Commentary, it's a brief commentary. Many of you may have that if you've got Logos or some of the online stuff. But be that as it may, it's not always great, but he has some good summaries, and that's why I cite him. But he argues that this, since this has already been dealt with in chapter 14, this must be a one-time thing in chapter 25. Maybe so. So back in 14, 28, and 29, that at the end of every third year, etc., you bring your tithe that you put aside, and it's to take care of the fatherless and the priest and the Levites, etc. Makes sense? All right. Now come to verse 12, and he repeats the same thing. But when you have finished laying aside all the tithe of the increase of the third year, verse 12, then you shall say before the Lord, I have removed, this is the ceremony you go through. I've removed the holy thing, and I've kept it for the Levite and the stranger and the fatherless and the widow, according to all your commandments, nor have I forgotten them. I hadn't forgotten your commandments. Hadn't forgotten that at all. I kept it. Now notice the extenuating circumstances that did not set aside the command of God. This is powerful. Look at verse 14. I have not eaten any of this when in mourning. In other words, I set aside the third year tithe, and I kept it set aside. And when I was mourning, I didn't let that crisis let me eat that. I didn't do that. I'll tell you something else I didn't do. Nor did I use it for anything unclean or give it for the dead. Some think that had reference to giving to the dead in some honor of idol. I think it probably, as many have suggested, giving it because someone has died. Maybe as we would take food to someone in crisis. There's a family that a loved one died and you take food. I've got food set aside. I could just take some of that. No, I didn't do that either. This is the third year tithe. So here's what I'm learning. That they were faithful even in the most extenuating circumstances, we didn't take anything and use it for any common use. Any application to that? You bet. There's all kind of application to that. I'm not going to let this crisis that I've got keep me from serving the Lord. And so you say, look down from your holy habitation and bless your people just as you swore and you gave us this land flowing with milk and honey. So this is an affirmation on the part of the worshiper that he too has kept his part of the covenant. God, I'm acknowledging you, verses 1 through 11, in the offering of the first fruits, you kept your promise. Here is the third year tithe, and I've been faithful to the promise too. Does that make sense? Then the covenant is ratified, as Kaufman suggests, in verses 16 to 19. So let's wrap up with 16 to 19 and then get a summary of the sermon. What goes on in these closing remarks? This is, if you were hearing this sermon, you can tell that Moses is winding down, and as we would call it, he's about to extend the invitation. It's about done. What's he saying in these closing remarks? Absolutely. He's really summarizing from back from chapter 5. These are the commandments, the statutes, and the judgments. Notice the wording, that you shall be careful to observe with all your heart and all your soul. And today you have proclaimed to the Lord your God that you shall walk in his ways, his commandments, and obey his voice. In other words, he's ending on the note that he ended the last sermon on, and that's obedience to the law. This is what the whole book's about, by the way. And the Lord God has proclaimed you to be a special people, just as he promised, and that he will set you high above the nations, just as he has spoken. Question number. When I can find it. Question number 8. In what sense, or what did their being special mean, or at least should mean to these people? Say again. Yeah, it should be an honor. They were a chosen generation, a royal priesthood. God chose this nation through whom the Messiah would come. And so God's taking care of this nation. And so they were a special people. They were separate. The bloodline was no, in other words, a Jew was of no more value than a pagan as far as the flesh and blood. It's the fact that they were God's special people through whom the Messiah was going to come. And if they obeyed God, they had a special relationship with God. And thus they were a special people. All right, let's summarize this sermon. You've heard the sermon. You've sat through that. You may have missed a part. It may be like listening to a sermon. You had to go out and to the restroom or go see to a kid, and you didn't get it all, but you got the bulk of it. How would you summarize if somebody said, I didn't hear the sermon? What was it about? What would you say? All right, keeping God's commandments so they'll be glorified as a nation. All right, what else? You heard the sermon. What's it about? Absolutely. Yeah, here's what's been done in the past, both good and bad, what God did for them, the mistakes they had made, and then here is the future crossing over into the land. Yeah, remembering. Those of you who play with AI know that at times they do a great job and sometimes they make an absolute mess. I ask AI, give me a summary of Moses' second sermon. And in case AI didn't know, that's chapter 5 to 26. And I don't think it did too bad a job summarizing. 4 points. I said summarize it in 3 or 4, so it chose 4. All right? Not a bad summary. The 5 through 11 deals with covenant renewal and core commands. I would probably reword that, but nonetheless, it is covenant renewal. Here is the re-emphasis of the Ten Commandments. The Shema, chapter 6, is right there, and warns them of blessings and curses. Yeah, that's what chapter 5 through 11 does, okay? Then 12 to 16, centralization of worship. That was the place where God chooses. Remember that chapter 12? God's going to find a central place. And he talks about destroying idols and pagan practices, etc. So here's the purity of worship and where worship will be in the purity of worship. So here's the commandments, and then here's the purity of worship. 16 to 21, as this outlines it, the righteous leadership and the national justice. And so here's instructions for kings and priests and prophets and etc. and the removal of evil from the community. Well, that's dealt with in 16 to 21. I agree with that. And then here's holiness of the community life, laws that govern marriage, sexuality, property, honest business practices. We saw the tithes, etc., a distinct and holy people. Not a bad summary, is it? So if you've heard that sermon and you sat through it and you say, well, that was a long one, but it had a point. What was he saying? He's trying to say, here's the law. Let's look within. He looked to the past in the first sermon, chapters 1 to 4. He's looking more within the nation here. In the next sermon, he's going to look toward the future, toward their going into the land. He's done that some here, but not to the degree he's going to later. Make sense? What else would you say? You've heard the sermon. Good point. Yeah, he is the Lord, he's the ruler, and he is your God. He is the Almighty. Question, go ahead. Yes, sir.
A lot of it is how to be a separate people and to fear God.
Good point. Yeah, chapter 17, you are a separate people, but how do you do that? This is what this section's about. This sermon is about. Question number 10. Practical things you've learned. We've got about a minute and a half, 2 minutes to go. We can get two or three of those in. Practical things that you learn from these chapters tonight.
The details that God lays out for a reason. He says at the end of the sermon that he lays them out because he expects you to do things a certain way, but also so you will remember, so you will not forget.
Good point. Remember, not forget. Which tells me that it is possible to forget things that I ought to know well. I ought to know well. Let's get another one or two. Practical things you take home with you.
God cares about the details. He didn't just create us and leave us to ourselves.
All right. Good point. Very good. I learned tonight that punishment should fit the crime. You don't kill the person who ought to be beaten, and you don't beat the person who ought to be set free. It ought to fit the offense. That's how we should deal with our children. You don't ground them for everything, but you don't say no just to everything. You make your dealing with them commensurate with what they have or have not done. One more. Let's get one more and we'll be done. Yeah. Honest and just and fair in all relationships, particularly in business. God demands that honesty in business. We'll stop right there. Our time is gone.